VOA News. Tommy McNeil. Israel is defending a Wednesday strike on a U.N. school-turned-shelter in central Gaza, claiming U.N. aid workers among the 18 killed were members of Hamas. VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadakoswara has this report.
The U.N. says that six of those killed work for UNRWA, the U.N. Agency for Palestinian Refugees, including the shelter's manager. Some 12,000 people are sheltering at the school. Israel defended the strike and said that the aid workers were in fact members of Hamas. Speaking from Poland Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken again called for a ceasefire and criticized both sides. Israel has repeatedly accused UNRWA workers of being tied to militant groups in Gaza. Patsy Wadakoswara, VOA News at the White House.
AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports on details of an investigation involving Iran.
The Justice Department is preparing criminal charges in an Iran hack targeting the Trump campaign. It's not clear what the charges will be or who is being targeted, but sources tell the AP it's the result of an FBI investigation into an intrusion that investigators quickly linked to an effort in Iran to influence this year's presidential election. Assistant Attorney General Matthew Olson said in a speech in New York, Iran perceives this year's elections to be particularly consequential in impacting its national security interest, increasing Tehran's inclination to try to shape the outcome. The Trump campaign disclosed last month it had been hacked and said Iranian actors stole and distributed sensitive internal documents. They were sent to Politico, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. Details of what was received were not revealed. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Nearly 200 people have died in Vietnam in the aftermath of Typhoon Yagi, and 128 people still missing as flash floods and landslides take their toll. Vietnam's VNE Express newspaper reported Thursday that 199 people have died. This is VOA News. AP correspondent Lisa Dwyer reports that North Korea has offered a rare glimpse into a weapons-grade uranium enrichment facility as Leader Kim pushes for more nuclear weapons.
State media reports that Leader Kim Jong-un visited the area and called for stronger efforts to exponentially increase the number of his nuclear weapons. It's the North's first public disclosure of a uranium enrichment facility since it showed one at Yongbyon to visiting American scholars in 2010. While the latest unveiling is a likely attempt to apply more pressure on the U.S. and its allies, the images released of the area could provide outsiders with a valuable source of information for estimating the amount of nuclear ingredients that North Korea has produced. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
The United States and Britain have pledged nearly $1.5 billion in additional aid to Ukraine during a visit to Kyiv by their top diplomats. Ukrainian officials used the occasion Wednesday to renew their pleas to use Western-provided missiles against targets deeper inside Russia. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced more than $700 million in humanitarian aid, while British Foreign Secretary David Lammy confirmed that his country would provide another $782 million in assistance and loan guarantees. Much of the effort was aimed at bolstering the energy grid that Russia has repeatedly pounded ahead of an expected difficult winter. U.S. Secretary of State Blinken said NATO allies were collaborating to impose consequences on Russia.
We are closely collaborating between ourselves, among different allies and partners, on, among other things, sharing the necessary information and taking steps to impose consequences on Russia for these attacks.
He also praised Poland for its progress in transitioning away from Russian energy since the war began. Hurricane Francine has slammed into the U.S. state of Louisiana as a dangerous Category 2 storm, knocking out power to more than a quarter million customers and threatening a large stretch of the Gulf Coast with flooding and destructive winds. Officials reported flooded streets and downed tree limbs Wednesday evening around southern Louisiana, while drenching rains in New Orleans raised fears of flash flooding. There was no immediate report of deaths or injuries. The National Hurricane Center says Francine ashore or came ashore from the Gulf of Mexico with nearly 100 mile per hour winds on Wednesday afternoon. After a few hours over land, Francine barely remained a hurricane as it churned inland. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, September 13, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. proposes two new permanent seats on the U.S. Security Council for Africa.
We have seen how African leadership not only benefits the lives of Africans, but people across the globe. So now it's time for African leadership to have a permanent place on the Security Council, too.
We'll have analysis of the proposal. A new report says if the Islamic State Somalia branch becomes a financial hub, its leader may become overall chief of the Islamic State for Africa. Kenyan President William Ruto visits Germany. Senegalese President Bassirou Diomaye Faye dissolves the National Assembly and calls for new legislative elections on November 17.
Because the majority at the parliament is not in his favor, he has arguments to get a parliament that accepts the agenda that he wants to put forward to resolve the Senegalese problem.
And as the gender gap among voters widens, will women push Kamala Harris to victory in the U.S. election? Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley Sports, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United States has proposed two new permanent seats on the U.N. Security Council for Africa, but as the French news agency reports, the new African seats will not have veto power over council resolutions. The announcement was made Thursday by U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, while speaking at the Council on Foreign Relations, a Washington-based think tank.
Today, I'm announcing the United States supports three additional changes to the Security Council. First, I want to start with Africa. As it stands, there are currently three non-permanent seats on the Security Council allocated to African countries on a rotating basis for 2 years. The problem is these elected seats don't enable African countries to deliver the full benefit of their knowledge and voices to the work of the Council, to consistently lead on the challenges that affect all of us and disproportionately affect Africa. That is why, in addition to non-permanent memberships for African countries, the United States supports creating two permanent seats for Africa on the Council. It's what our African partners seek, and we believe this is what is just. From Kenya's contribution to the multilateral security support mission in Haiti to Gabon's support to protect our planet, we have seen how African leadership not only benefits the lives of Africans, but people across the globe. So now it's time for African leadership to have a permanent place on the Security Council, too. Much of the conversation around Security Council reform has been just that. It's a conversation. We sit around the table every year, and as one of my colleagues said, we just give the same speech over and over and over again. And so many of these countries I've talked to, spanning vastly different approaches and opinions, agree that it's time to stop talking in circles, stop repeating what we've said year in and year out, and take action, to actually put down our principles on paper and began the process of getting a resolution over the finish line. I'm an optimist, though, and I'm also a realist. And the reality is this: no amount of conversations will ever get us to a place of total consensus on this issue. The good news is we've been here before. And so my final announcement is that the United States supports engaging in text-based negotiations on council reform. It means we're ready to work with other countries to negotiate language, prepare amendments, and ready this resolution for a vote in the General Assembly and ultimately amend the UN Charter.
That was U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, speaking Thursday at the Council on Foreign Relations, a Washington-based think tank. The United States has proposed two new permanent seats on the UN Security Council for Africa. Kweku Nuama is a professor in the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C. He tells me that he is not sure if Africa would accept the U.S. offer, considering that Africa has been asking for two permanent seats with a veto, which is not included in the U.S. offer.
It is exactly what we thought she was going to propose, which is the two
permanent seat, but without the veto. And I don't know whether that is acceptable to Africa, because Africa has been demanding two seats with the veto. And then Africa also wants its three rotating member seats increased to five. And I don't know whether Africa is going to get all of that. But I still think that it's a beginning, not an end. And Africa can accept this and push for more. But that would require Africa to work with the other members, the Chinese and maybe Russia, to see if they can come to some type of agreement. I don't think the veto is on the table, but what Africa could do is request more permanent seats, which can then be allocated either to the regional economic communities or come up with some type of formula that doesn't have one country or the permanent countries holding it forever. But you could have a deal where, for example, we elect countries to go in for 5 years or even 10 years, and then it shifts to another country. And so we can work out those formulas simply. But we need more representation. The United Nations has to allow this to happen because it is losing legitimacy.
Well, Professor, do you think this time around the United States is serious? Because as the ambassador said, the United States is willing to work hard. As she said, it will take a lot of negotiations. So do you think this time around the United States is willing to work hard?
Well, the United States has to at least try, because the United States is competing with Russia and China for influence in Africa. And so it has to come to the table with something. And this is the offer that they are making. The Chinese also have to step up and tell Africa how it is going to help us. The Russians, too, have to step up and make an offer. But the United States, if it wants to get this done, it can do it. The question is whether there's a political will to do it. There's an election coming that may change the calculus. But if the United States wants to get this done, it can be done. There's nothing written in stone at the United Nations. There's been so many changes. So if you are willing to do the work, I think that with the Chinese on the horizon and the Russians on the horizon, this becomes a priority for the United States.
Kweku Nuama is a professor in the School of International Service at American University here in Washington, D.C. Senegalese President Bassirou Diomaye Faye has dissolved the opposition-led National Assembly and called for new legislative elections on November 17. The French news agency reports that government programs had been hampered by the lack of a majority in parliament for Faye's party. Senegalese political analyst Ibrahima Khan tells me that President Faye has the constitutional right to dissolve the legislature.
The president has the constitutional right to dissolve the parliament. And because the majority at the parliament is not in his favor, he has arguments to really try to get a parliament that accepts the agenda that he wants to put forward to resolve the Senegalese problem. But the one problem is that last week, the president adopted a decree. And in that decree, he announced that the prime minister was going tomorrow to present at the parliament the policy that he wants his government to implement, and which is a constitutional obligation of the prime minister every time a new prime minister is nominated. But now, with the decision to dissolve the parliament, that presentation cannot be made. At the same time, the president is also contradicting himself.
Now he has scheduled, elections for November 17? So how likely that he will regain majority in parliament?
Yes, but that's any decision to dissolve a parliament. Maybe he knows many things that we, you and me, don't know. But I have to say that the dissolution of the parliament happens in a period where the former ruling party is divided. The former prime minister just decided the day before yesterday to create his new party. Other political parties and coalition since the presidential election are not really showing what they can do. The only thing that we can say is that the Parti Socialiste, who was the first ruling party in the country in the 60s, and lastly, I'm not quite sure that the current presidential party is ready enough. It was dissolved by Macky Sall. All the structures of the party were dismantled. And now that they came back in 4 months, is it a machine that is capable of going into a campaign and get the majority of MPs. It's a question mark so far.
Ibrahima Khan is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with us from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 13th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. President William Ruto left Kenya on Thursday evening for a two-day official visit to Germany aimed at strengthening bilateral relations between the two nations. Local media, citing State House spokesperson Hussein Mohammed, said the president's visit will feature high-level engagements, including the signing of the Kenya-Germany Agreement on Comprehensive Migration and Mobility Partnership. Political analyst David Monda tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that the visit is a very important one.
It's very important because Germany and Kenya have had very close diplomatic relationships. Germany is Kenya's largest trading partner within the East African community. Kenya is a key conduit and avenue to the rest of the East and Central African region for German goods and services. A lot of major German multinationals, whether it's Bayer, whether it's Hooks, whether it's, you know, Mercedes-Benz, a lot of their pharmaceutical companies are based in Nairobi. And, of course, Nairobi is a major diplomatic center, being the center for the United Nations Environmental Program, for the habitat. And both Germany and Kenya are NATO allies, Germany being a strategic central founding member of NATO and Kenya being a non-NATO ally. So there are a lot of areas of cooperation that the two countries can build on with this trip.
Talking of areas of cooperation, one that's being highlighted is the employment opportunities for the youth and enhanced educational and vocational opportunities. Many Kenyans have been expecting this to go through. Do you think they can pull it off?
I think they can definitely pull it off, and particularly with the government's drive to look for alternative sources of employment for Kenyans. Although this has been very controversial even in Kenya itself, because there's some critics of this program who say that the government should really be generating jobs in Kenya, not trying to find ways to send its best human capital abroad. But even having said that, I think this is an important conduit for labor migration and regularized labor migration. So people are moving from the global south, in this context, a developing country like Kenya, to industrialized countries like Germany, that there's formal agreements that when Kenyans are going to Germany, they have contracts, they have, you know, their labor rights are protected, you know, their human rights protected, wage issues, and so on and so forth. But the Germany also gets to benefit because it's a huge economy. Its population is shrinking. It needs young people to work. And the German economy is the largest economy in Europe, so they are expanding. So they need this labor. So I think it's a win-win for both countries. But like I said, there is that hanging critique of the government that maybe it should also be focusing on expanding the economy locally so Kenyans are not forced to have to go to foreign countries to find work.
That was David Morda, a professor of political science at the City University of New York. He spoke from New York with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. The International Crisis Group says Islamic State in Somalia has become an important financial influence for terrorism. A report suggests the leader of the IS Somalia branch might become the new overall head of the militant group as IS seeks to expand its operations in Africa. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Islamic State in Somalia may not be as active on the battlefield as its local counterparts, the Al-Qaeda-linked terror group Al-Shabaab, which controls large parts of southern and central Somalia. However, the International Crisis Group says in a report released Thursday, IS Somalia is building relations with other IS branches and is able to disperse money to finance terror operations in other African countries. Omar Mahmoud is a senior researcher with the International Crisis Group. He says that IS Somalia plays a bigger role externally than Al-Shabaab.
Al-Shabaab's by far and away the bigger threat. But at the same time, Islamic State Somalia has won. It's persisted despite some significant odds against it. And two, it's carved out a role for itself within the wider Islamic State network, particularly when it comes to serving as a financial hub between some of the affiliates and other parts of the Islamic State.
The International Crisis Group says Islamic State restructured its African operations in 2020, placing affiliates from the Democratic Republic of Congo and Mozambique under the watch of IS headquarters in Somalia's Puntland region. IS Somalia is reported to have between 100 and 400 fighters stationed in the northern part of the country. According to the ICG, about half of the fighters are believed to be foreigners. Early this year, Puntland authorities arrested six Islamic State members who were Moroccans, who were later deported. According to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, since May of this year, the group has been increasingly active and has waged several attacks against security forces and business centers. IS Somalia has also increased its activities in the port city of Bosaso and its surroundings, carrying out an extortion racket which it uses to support its fighters and activities. Richard Tuta, Kenyan counterterrorism expert, says Somalia's lack of a strong central government has enabled Somalia to be a financial hub of the IS group.
Somalia, the mentioned countries, does not have strong institutions, so it is very easy for such institutions to be compromised.
In May, the U.S. carried out airstrikes in Somalia targeting IS leader Abdul Qadir Mumin. Mumin survived. The ICG calls for cooperation between the Somali government in Mogadishu and Puntland regional authorities to tackle IS Somalia and urges outside actors to pay closer attention to the group's activities. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
The U.S. presidential race between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump remains tight, but Harris has opened a sizable lead over Trump among one group of voters, women, who vote at higher rates than men. As VOA's Dora Mekwa reports, Harris's late entry into the race widened the political party's gender gap.
Since 1984, more women than men have voted in U.S. presidential elections. And, for the most part, more of them vote for Democrats than vote for Republicans. Vice President Kamala Harris's sudden entry into the race, following President Joe Biden's July withdrawal, appears to have fired up this voting bloc. Erin Covey is with the Cook Political Report.
We have seen a pretty significant shift across a lot of different demographics, but with women in particular, who are now much more likely to vote for the Democrat at the top of the ticket than they were when it was Biden.
This election year, roughly one in five women say abortion rights is their key issue. In 2022, Supreme Court justices nominated by then-President Donald Trump helped eliminate constitutional rights to an abortion. Trump wants each state to decide abortion laws. Harris wants federal legislation to protect reproductive freedom nationwide. That is why these voters say they're backing Harris.
She's trying to create a world where people all have their rights to their own decisions, their bodies, their choices, women's rights.
She's for the people, which is the middle class, which I am middle class, and the laws about women's rights.
Among female voters, the latest poll suggests that Harris leads Trump by anywhere from 9 to 13 points, says pollster Paul Maslin.
She gained a lot of younger women who, independents, nonpartisan voters under the age of 50, many of them under 40, who really got excited by her candidacy.
Here's Erin Covey.
Black women are a lot more likely to vote for Harris now, Hispanic women. So, you know, as we have seen her do better with a lot of these specific racial demographics or educational demographics, we have seen with women, that is really where that shift is coming from.
Male voters favor Trump by anywhere from 5 to 9 points, depending on the poll. These Trump supporters are from Georgia and Montana.
First, her being the candidate is really, this is like horrific to me because, first of all, she's not prepared to be president.
For months, we would barely ever see Joe Biden, and all of a sudden, Kamala Harris is the nominee for the Democratic Party when she was never nominated in the first place. She came out of nowhere.
The gender gap persists among young voters in Gen Z, where a majority of men under the age of 27 favor Trump, according to pollster David McLennan.
There has been an increase in terms of the admiration of some Gen Z young men for, you know, swagger. It's very much a macho punch him in the face kind of thing.
McLennan says young men are politically socialized by online sources, where they often see and hear unflattering opinions about female leaders.
So they believe that women can't make the tough decisions if the United States were to go to war or face international crisis. They don't believe that women have the ability to make the tough call.
White women were key to Trump's victory in 2016. He also won a majority of white women in 2020. In this race, the latest polls show Harris and Trump statistically tied among white women. Dora McQuarr, VOA News, Washington.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the CAF Champions League. The CAF Champions League second preliminary round matches will return this weekend, with several matches scheduled to be played across various venues on the continent. Reigning Kenyan champions Gor Mahia will highly rely on home advantage in their first leg match against Egyptian giants Al Ahly on Sunday at the Nyayo National Stadium. Leonardo Nivea wants his charges to go all out and claim victory, and is confident that Gor Mahia can use home advantage to spring a surprise on their visitors.
We should push ourselves, you know, to try maintain the high level of football, to be able to play against them over here. That's why you should play over here very, very well.
In Nigeria, Rangers International of Enugu will take on Angolan side Sagrada Esperanca at the Gospel Akpabio International Stadium in Uyo on Friday. Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa will play their scheduled away match against Mbabane Swallows of Eswatini in familiar territory of the Lucas Morepe Stadium on Saturday evening. The second leg will be played still in South Africa at the Loftus Versfeld Stadium the following weekend. Sundowns coach Manuka Mgiti is great that his team will play both legs of the CAF Champions League second preliminary round at home.
And if we were supposed to be traveling tomorrow or maybe traveling today to Swaziland, it could have been even more difficult for us. But the fact that the game is played locally gives us a little bit of a chance to have our players, and also maybe for them to take part in our matchday minus one training without much issues.
In athletics, South Africa's 800 meters rising star Prudence Sekodizo will line up for the Wanda Diamond League final on Friday night in Brussels. Sekodizo cut through to the final of the two-lap contest after she clinched the first place in the two Diamond League races, first in Marrakesh, Morocco, in a world leading time of 1 minute 57.26 seconds, and then in Oslo, Norway, running 1 minute 58.66 seconds. In cycling news, the third edition of the Jubilee Life Free Cycling Race, powered by Grand Nairobi Bike Race, has been scheduled for Sunday, the 29th of September. The Jubilee Life Free Race will feature six thrilling categories. The International Premier Cycling Event will bring together up to 2,500 elite cyclists from 21 countries, including Ethiopia, Eritrea, USA, France, and the East African Community, for an intense and adrenaline-fueled competition. In basketball, four teams are set to battle for a final berth at the ongoing Under-18 Women's Afro Basket in South Africa, with two regulars, a debutant, and a second returning for the first time in over a decade involved. And that does it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, September 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.